here, because to get through this chapter, so we'll kind of go through these. We've talked about some of this stuff already, but I noticed, as in other chapters as well, and other texts, that we can get a lot of reaction, a lot of commentary out of this text. So I'm trying to synthesize. We only have a couple more classes, I guess. What's the date? I'm kind of lost track of time.
The 20th?
Yeah. 24. Yeah, I think we have just this class and the next one. So we got to get through John 9, and then we'll start next quarter. Whoever's still with us, we'll start next quarter, John chapter 10. I think it's the first time we've done a two-quarter class like that. So, charting new territory. I know some of you be teaching it also.
Okay. We did that with Romans once, didn't we?
Did we do Romans? I thought we skipped a quarter, but I'm not sure. Maybe not. Maybe not. Yeah, we kind of said it separated that. That one separates a little more easily than John does. John doesn't most separate at all. Okay, so if you notice, just kind of go down the numbers, and obviously make any comments you'd like, but they're kind of in order of the verses that we're covering here. And the first note is that the healing of the blind man illustrates Jesus' assertion that he is the light of the world, which of course we saw back in chapter 1, and then in chapter 8, and in this chapter. So we see that at least three times when he calls himself, or he is referred to as the light of the world. And of course that the image is obvious. He comes into a dark world, as Peter says on the day of Pentecost, a crooked world, a crooked generation. He comes in and brings light into that. So I think this healing of the blind man, this particular sign is specifically aimed at illustrating that point. He does it here in a literal sense, but of course there's the spiritual meaning. What is the spiritual meaning to what he does here? We know he heals a blind man, okay, so what's the spiritual meaning for that?
I'm blind, but now I see.
I'm blind, now I see. Yes. We sing that, Amazing Grace, right? So, wretched people that we are. No, right. So, spiritually blind, right? I mean, making that. What is darkness? What's another word for darkness?
Sin,
right? So, and we walk in the light as he is in the light. You know, 1 John 1 and all of that. Okay, so then we talked about that on Sunday. Then on from verse 2, the disciples repeat the common view, kind of the conventional wisdom, that if you are having issues, in health issues, then some, you do something wrong. You're your parents' sin. That's the conventional wisdom. What's interesting here, and I have a question here. Their view of this comes kind of honestly from statements in the Old Testament that the sins of the fathers will be visited on the children for generations to come. And that's stated several times. I got the scriptures down there. What did that mean? When the text says that this is going to happen, that's going to visit it on the children, what does that mean?
Consequences. Not that they're born into sin, but that because they disobey God, then three generations later, you're going to be oppressed by the Amalekites or whatever.
Yeah. Right. It's not a matter of transference of sin. It's a matter of the consequences for living in sin. So nothing really changed. They're just when Ezekiel says that the soul that sins it shall die, and the sins of the father are not attached to the son. Nothing really changed. He's just elucidating, just explaining the reality of the fact that when each person who sins stands on his own. And so, I don't get off into this right now, but kind of a comment on total depravity and all that kind of thing. You know, there's got to be some sin there. It's not a transferring from Adam or anybody else. That's how it works. So, then on number three, we're going to slow down here in a minute, but he responds that neither
It's not about the man sinning or his parents sinning. But he says this, but that the works of God might be displayed in him, verse 3. So the question I have, does that suggest that God caused this? Did he make this man blind so that he could do this sign?
I do not think that implies that. I think what it implies is God can take any situation and find a purpose.
Okay.
For it.
Okay. That's a plausible explanation. Yes, Lynn.
As a consequence of free will and the random nature of this world, sometimes things are going to happen. And, things happen, they still happen.
People are born blind.
Yeah, I mean, nowhere in there does it say that God had a hand in it.
Okay.
Nor is, I don't think it's blind.
It doesn't seem, does it, if he had this man, if he caused this man to be born blind, that's the implication, does that sound like God? I mean, does that sound like the character of God? Doesn't fit his character, does it, that we see unfold? I mean, so while it's sort of worded that way, I agree with your comments. I think, in fact, God always takes people as he finds them. He gives them free will. He took Pharaoh as he found him, and he worked his work in him because that's who he was. He pretty well proved who he was. He hardened his heart, I think, at least four times before God started hardening his heart. So there's an alternate reading of verse 3 and 4, by the way, that I put in here. And that because it's based on punctuation. In the original Greek, course, there's no punctuation, so the translators haven't put it in there. And it says, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him, we must work the works of him. That's a possible alternate reading of that. It just depends on where you put the period. See that? So we don't know for sure, but
I think that's what I was kind of thinking, that just maybe if the man were not blind, then there's no place for a miracle to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so the works of God can't be displayed in someone who doesn't need help.
Yeah.
And I mean, you could say that literally and figuratively, of course, but like how Jesus said, he came to help the sick or whatever, spiritually sick and all that. But if the guy weren't blind, then this never would have happened.
Yeah, we wouldn't be reading this here. There's another case that's recorded in other Gospels, but same with the lame man. Man's lame, paralyzed. Well, that's where we find it. There's no indication in any of those other texts that God made him that way. So there are plenty of those people around, for one thing. There are plenty of lame people, blind people, and all that. This man, though, he chose because he was blind from birth. And I think, again, if you've heard Brady's talk on that, you know how significant that is. And try to make time for that maybe on Sunday, for at least a brief version of that. Yes, Thomas.
Well, in chapter 11, when he's talking about the servant of Lazarus, in verse 4, he says, "But when Jesus heard this, he said, 'This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of Man may be glorified by it.'" And so if you think it's just stated a little bit easier than that, it's kind of a sin isn't brought up in that passage, but the whole concept of God being glorified by that. So that situation exists. He got sick. God didn't cause it. Just like with the blind man, he didn't necessarily cause the blindness, but he's gonna use that situation.
Right. He died, so and then he raised him. Yes.
I think the other notable thing about the difference between this blind man and other people that Jesus has healed, to a large extent anyway, so I don't know if this is exclusionary here, but most of the time that there's a healing, it's because someone has come up to Jesus and asked for it, or some family member has brought this person to Jesus, or some family member has come to Jesus with this problem, and this is what we want to see, or this is how we want the resolution. And that's not the case here. This is just a blind man sitting there, and Jesus came and Jesus' purpose in his heart to help this man without any, at least in the text, without any urging of the blind man.
Amy.
Add to Brady's point here, the other time so far in John where he's taken the initiative was also on the Sabbath day. So,
yeah.
I mean, it seems that there's a pattern, right, where Jesus's intentions include an opportunity to deliver a critique to a particular audience. And so if those are the occasions when he's going to initiate, perhaps, whereas otherwise it's...
Yeah, and we see that through the other Gospels as well, the initiating of these things on the Sabbath day in order to make a point. It's good observations. Number four down here, it says, he goes on to say, verse 4 and 5, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work, as long as I am in the world, I'm the light of the world. I find that a little bit difficult to understand. So anybody have a thought on that? Particularly, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. What is that night is coming when no one can work? That's the thing that hangs me up a little bit. I have my thoughts, but what do you think? I know this is Wednesday night, so a few of you want to talk, but... Yeah, Aaron?
This is probably not it. However, this was kind of like what I thought when I read. This is what this made me think of when I read it, even though I don't necessarily think it's saying this.
Okay, well, but we won't throw you out of the class if you didn't. Okay.
That there is going to be a judgment at some point. And at that point in time, when that happens, there's going to be nothing else that you can do. You're not going to be able to go back and change your mind. You're not going to be able to do anything else. That's going to be it.
Night is the judgment.
That's what it made me think of when I saw that. Night is coming when no one can work.
Okay.
That time is going to come. And so you better do your work and make your changes now.
Okay. That's possible. Scott, did you hear it?
Well, thoughts again. And one thing in here is he says, while I am in the world, I'm the light of the world. So after he's gone from the world, well, he's still the light of the world, but not there physically. But another thought is, I do think this is a comparison. It's kind of figurative. Light represents when I'm in the world. Dark represents when I'm not in the world. And we all know that in the daytime you work, and at night until... we got artificial lights. You can't work. So it's done. So I won't be here. I won't be here for long, but I'm here.
Yeah. Okay. That's another view.
Could this be referring to miracles? He just performed one, and he says, we got to do the works of him who sent me while it's day. He's the light, so it's day when he's dead and gone, or been raised and gone, I guess I should say. Then that goes away, and so then it's just what he's left.
Possibly. The apostles do miracles, so... in terms of that being a direct relation to that.
That would be the we, right? I mean,
I guess verse 5 is the punctuation on the statement in verse 4. Mm-hmm. So in verse 4, when he's saying, got to do this, first of all, it's interesting, it says, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. So consider that, but... night's coming when no one can work, and then I think he's going on to say, as long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. In a sense that he is speaking, well, I'm literally here in the flesh, in the form of Jesus, doing this very specific thing. The ministry part of it, the miracles part of it, the whole point of this has been the declaration that I am the Son of God. And then I'm going to be lifted up, I'm going to be resurrected, and we're going to prove all of that. While I'm literally here, there's some literal things, there's some physical things I've got to do to demonstrate that and be the light of the world. I think that's where he's initially going here. In a beautiful sense, which is often the way he seems to work, this will have some sort of application after he's physically gone and risen in heaven, because he's after that, he has established himself as the Son of God. And he,
as the Messiah, is always here and will always be the light of the world if we're willing to access him and we're willing to plug into that. So I think he's kind of saying, I'm not going to be here forever. I'm not going to be doing this forever. I'm not going to be physically in your presence forever. I'm not going to be doing miracles forever. I'm not going to be demonstrating my power forever. And I'm not going to be speaking to you forever. While I am here, I got to do those things because a time's coming where I'm not going to be here.
Yeah.
Then I think you can extrapolate from that after he's gone, wow, in some sense, he's still here and he's still the light of the world, and that'll make a whole lot more sense.
Yeah.
You know, once the church is established. And
yeah. Good. I mean, in Luke 22:53, says just before his death, this is your hour in the power of darkness. So there's a reference there to the darkness or the night. John 13:30, Judas goes out and he says, and it was night. You know, it's kind of the beginning of the end. And so there's this night coming, which involves, the, as some of you said, the exit of Jesus from this physical world. You had your hand up.
Oh, I have a comment.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
I got nothing to say, sorry.
Thomas.
I don't know if this is too literal and there's no connection here, but I find it peculiar that he says the word work three times, and it's the Sabbath.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's trying to draw something out there and make a point for them.
Works. We got to work. It's Sabbath. You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, except in the really weird way that we decided we can work. That's what the Jews are actually doing. They've decided there's certain work they can do, but you got to do it our way. Jeff, did you have a comment?
No. I don't know. I'm struggling. Dave brought out the point that I'm wrestling with. We're in verse 5. I mean, wouldn't we say still here now that Jesus is the light of the world? That's a right now statement. It's true.
Yeah.
So it seems like the whole... It seems like it has a spiritual application versus a physical application, if that's the case. Yeah. Being able to work versus not work. If that statement is correlated to the previous statement of night and day, maybe it's not. Maybe that's how we reconcile it, but I don't know how the interpretation works if it's dark once Jesus dies or once Jesus ascends back into heaven, that's when the darkness comes. That doesn't like tie out with what he then says in verse 5.
Okay. We'll come back to Luke.
Well, I'm kind of with Aaron. I'm not sure if I know what I'm talking about. So I can't
it seems evident none of us do this passage.
Yeah, we're all...
But it says, as long as I...
Next quarter, we'll have a class on this passage. we'll have the whole quarter on the back. Go ahead.
It says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world.
And right.
I would think that he was the light of the world when he was here, and of course, he established the church, and now... The church is the light of the world, and we as Christians,
his disciples,
make up the church and are the lights of the world. But I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, I could give you the same disclaimer everybody else has, but I see this very kind of a narrow application. I think some of you said this, or at least just part of the answer. I see it as the night. When is the night coming? The night is coming when they take him and kill him. And he's not going to do any work during that time. He's not going to do these miracles. Well, he could have done some really huge miracles when they arrested him, right? I mean, there's some things that happen. Like, they come to arrest him, and all the guys fall back, you know. And when he says, I am he, they fall back, and those kinds of things. But the work that he's doing now is going to be cut short. And half of this book is the last week of his life. This is unique to John. And so that night, that's a big... section of this whole gospel is the night part, his arrest and crucifixion, not the resurrection so much, of course, but that period. And I think you'll start to see this when Judas goes out, and John adds that little statement after he washes the feet of the disciples, and during the Lord's Supper apparently, and all that, the Passover, and then Judas goes out, and he goes, and it was night. You know, that kind of stuff, you just kind of, what's he getting at? Well, Judas is going into the night, because he's going to betray him. He's going to go into this realm of night. And so I think all he's saying here, he says, we can do works up to that time, but this time is coming when I'm not going to work. You can't, where did the disciples go when they arrested him? They scattered all over, right? They weren't doing anything. In fact, Peter's warming his hands with the John brings that out in John 18. He's warming his hands with the enemies. Judas, of course, is going to betray him. All the disciples are spread out. So that's, I see it as having a kind of a very narrow meaning. I mean, we can extract some spiritual lessons from that, of course, but I see the specific meaning. So all those, but any of those things you mentioned are plausible and possible because we don't know for sure. So we'll leave it at that. So all of
your... Fortunately, our salvation doesn't hinge on this passage.
Well, how do we know? Where does it say that, Jeff? Yeah, fortunately. That's we can say that a lot, right? Other stuff. Okay. Number 5, verse 6 and 7. Okay, this is really interesting. Jesus spits on the ground. Some believe that saliva had medical powers back then. So, I mean, even in the physical kind of realm, they believe that. Of course, I don't want anybody spitting on me. But then again, if Jesus was there and...
That, he didn't spit on him.
Well, eventually it got to him. It got to his eyes.
We know he doesn't have to, right? Like, he can say, arise and walk. He can say, now you can see. So I'm wondering, like, is the physicality of this miracle related to this idea of works that Thomas was just mentioning? Like, he's doing something very, like, he's doing something with his hands, and so maybe that kind of pushes the Sabbath question more.
Yeah.
I don't know. I need an adjective. Can't find it. Pushes it more something. Hardly.
Hardly. Tyler.
I just think that Amy's point, verse 14, that was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes, and that's what the Pharisees had an issue with.
Right. Yeah. So it that's called attention to that. So the work, the whole work Sabbath thing certainly enters into all this. He's challenging them at a very basic level. I mean, he's not going to them and saying, "Hey, you can work on the Sabbath. You can do some work on the Sabbath." He's doing work on the Sabbath that then causes them to react to that, and it's going to come in, of course, as we read on.
I think it's probably that. However, it gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling, too, I think, when I think about the fact that we were created in Genesis 2 from the dust of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus is kind of showing his power as creator by using the dust of the earth to give the man a new
set. Yeah, I like that. Fact. Those of you of my generation, you remember the song, 100 Pounds of Clay?
Mm-hmm.
Talking about his girlfriend, his... She's 100 pounds of clay. You know, remember that one? Yeah. So there you go. Look it up. YouTube it if you haven't heard it. How many know that song? Actually, you've heard it. It's an oldie. Okay, look on this side of the room. Come on.
Really?
No, 100 pounds of clay.
We don't
want to
know.
It's a good song. It's a golden oldie. I know Allison for sure will go home and YouTube it right away, right? 100 pounds of clay. But it's a good song.
You need like old, like from the 80s or
50s. 50s. Really ancient. It's one of those ancient songs.
So. They even have instruments.
50s to the 2000, 70 years old. Well, it's not. I don't think it's quite that. Sometime mid 50s. So, say 65 years old. So, when I was like in high school, 65 years old would have been the turn of the century, like 1900. That's scary. Okay, anyway, this is what I really like about this text. I'm just going to tell you, not try to coax it out of you, but you can see I wrote it down there. How often does Jesus say in the gospel so far that his Father has sent him? He sent him. I'm the one who is sent, is speaking. You know, he says that many times. Just go back and, you know, do concordance and look how many times he says he's sent from God, from the Father. Well, the Siloam, which is also Shiloh in the Old Testament, means sent. So, see what's going on here? the one who is sent sends the man to the pool to wash his, because that's, he didn't have to do either, but there's some work involved in that. He sends the man to the pool that's called sent. I think that's kind of neat.
No? Sends him, yeah, to the place to get his sight so he can see the light.
Yes.
The light comes to send the guy to send to see the light.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. We could probably, so, it is very poetic.
Siloam?
Siloam means sent.
That means sent?
Sent. Shiloh, is, Old Testament is Shiloh. Oh. Just maybe more people are familiar with that.
And they would have known that, of course.
Yeah, so. Yeah. But they, and
he's
Jesus
really
said,
he's
making a point. And he's making him do work on the Sabbath.
If only he couldn't smell, he would have restored his scent.
I know. If we had that in there, then we'd really have something. Take this to another level.
Yeah. You must be a dad joke.
Very good. That is such a dad joke. Get you all started. So we're only in 6-7 verses here, so we're okay. We've got another class. So what we get next then is this: these reactions. I just want to spend the rest of time on this tonight, and I want to spend, time on the reactions that we get here between different people, and then the judgment point, which I think we've already had a discussion on, but I think we need a little more on that because. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says, I did not come to judge, and he says, I came to judge. So we've got to, I don't know if you've worked that all out. I wasn't here one Sunday or whenever it was. So the reactions, and okay, so I did a little thing, the man formerly known as the blind man. I kind of felt like I didn't want to call him the blind man anymore, because he wasn't blind. So I thought the seeing man was kind of, the sighted man was kind of ironic. So I thought of Prince. The artist formerly known as Prince.
Yeah, it's a little symbol. We were just having this little side conversation.
Yeah. So that's what that means. I put that down there. The man formerly known as the blind man. To kind of emphasize that he's been healed of his blindness. So anyway. You can't pronounce it, so it's not like a very good acronym or anything. But so you have the exchange between the man formerly known as the blind man, the neighbors, the Pharisees, the parents, and eventually the ex-blind man is cast out of the synagogue in this section from 8 to 34. So let's look at this and kind of see what's going on here. I know we've had some conversations about how can people miss this. We talked about that on Sunday. I mean, when you see a man who's, everybody knew had been blind for a long time, at least whether they knew from birth or not, they know he'd been sitting out there blind for all this time, and not get the point. But you see this very interesting reaction. So first we have the neighbors in verse 8. And it says, the neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, it is. Others said, no, but he is like him. He kept saying, I'm the man. Okay. This is like one of the funniest chapters in the Bible. I'm sorry. It just is. And it's this guy. I'd love to meet this guy. I'm going to look him up in heaven, you know. I don't know I'm looking for the man formerly known as the blind man.
He's doing stand-up comedy.
Yeah, he's in the comedy club of heaven. But he's so bold. I know this was brought out on Sunday. A few of you made this point. But he's so bold, and it's just like he can't, they had nothing on him. He was a beggar. He had nothing. It's hilarious to me that they cast him out at the end. They cast him out of the synagogue. I've never been inside the synagogue. It's just like, okay, so they're going to cast you out. And he says, oh. It's like, ooh, I'm worried. His parents were worried, but we'll get to that in a minute. Okay, so what does it say, though? So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, I know it seems a little weird that people are like, they totally know him, but then they're saying, no, but it really looks like him. No, it's like him. But it did make me think, like, okay, have I ever had anything similar to that? And so just, like, bear with me for a moment. But there was this guy in high school, and he was weird, and everybody knew who he was, because he would wear a three-piece suit and carry a briefcase as a junior in high school. And it was just this guy. I remember his last name was Glass. And then the next year, his senior year, he shows up, and he has this short, you know, he looked like Wall Street, whatever, junior year. Then he shows up, his hair is down to here, he looks like Jimi Hendrix, dressed like Jimi Hendrix, and people are like, isn't that so-and-so Glass? And I'm like, me and others, but I'm like, no, he was carrying a briefcase 3 months ago, you know, but it was him, and he was weird. Like, I'm going to reinvent myself over the summer, and then that's how he looked senior year. But I did not think it was him, because I didn't think it was possible. And that's way lower level than someone who is blind, and you know that is not changing, and then you see him, and I think that would be my reaction. Like, that really resembles him.
Yeah.
But it can't be him.
It's out of
context.
But
then he's saying, hello, it's me, but...
Yeah.
I'm the guy. Your classroom.
Ready.
So, I don't know about that guy that Allison knows, but I'll tell you, if you want to nerd out on this just a little bit, I'll tell you what I think about this. Not that you asked, but I'm going to tell you. If you're really blind from birth, there's all kinds of different problems with you. Not only just being blind, but your orientation in space is totally different than everybody else. You have no reason to have a vertical posture at all. Laying down is just as effective for you as sitting upright. You don't develop those muscles in order to be able to stand or to sit upright because you've been blind from birth and your orientation is all funky and different and it's not normal, right? So that blind man looks different when he's been blind from birth than he does after Jesus heals him. I think this miracle has some similarities to the blind man that was healed in Mark 8 for that reason, because it's almost as if it's a two-part miracle. Number one is getting that guy up off the floor to walk to the pool that Jesus wants him to go to. That's kind of the first part. And the blind man in Mark chapter 8 was healed, if you guys remember, in two different phases as well. And in chapter 8, the blind man says, when Jesus says, can you see? He says, I see people upright walking like trees. That's an interesting comment. What does that mean? Is he talking about the fact that his orientation has always been horizontal, and now all of a sudden he's realizing that he feels the trees and sees people walking as if they're trees, and then Jesus heals him the rest of the way like he does to the blind man after the blind man goes to the pool? So he's unrecognizable to the neighbors and people that knew him because he doesn't look the same.
Right.
So they're legitimately confused by the fact that he, like Allison said with her friend, just had this complete transformation. Even
acquaintance.
More so.
I think that's how Mike Wilson used to go to FCU. Three-piece suit. Briefcase.
We'll have to get some photographic evidence.
Yeah. How about to add to that, Brady? How about eyes that would be like gray, or just you know, you see somebody's blind when they're right. I mean, and they're you see people have blind.
Well, he could look normal there. Although it does make me wonder how did Jesus know that he was blind from birth when he walked by, and his disciples pointed out and said that man's. Well, the disciples, I guess, actually knew. They were the first ones to say anything. So maybe there is some kind of appearance.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've seen people with blindness that do have the gray.
If you had congenital cataracts, for example, you'd probably pick up on those.
Yeah,
and that would make you blind from birth in a third world country.
So, well, I guess what we're saying is it's certainly not unusual that people would maybe not recognize him or think that maybe he had a twin or something But he then just confirms that, and of course the space he occupied for so long is gone. I mean, he's not sitting there anymore, where he always sit. So that's the first. These are neighbors. I don't know how often, and I think this might be the only time I remember John using that term, neighbors, here. I don't know if there's any importance to that. Usually it's the crowd or the people, but these are his neighbors. And I think it's emphasizing the fact that these are people who knew him These are people who live next door to him, you know, and next door to his little plot, and whatever, and that sort of thing. And so he confirms that he's the guy. So, verse 10, they ask, then how were your eyes opened? The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. Okay, so that's straightforward, right? The man named Jesus. So everybody knew who Jesus was. He wasn't, even later on when Agrippa, you know, Paul's talking to Agrippa, they say he wasn't done in a corner. You know, they know, you know what's going on. And that gets the Pharisees' attention, of course. But he said, where did they go? Where is he? And he said, I do not know. So Jesus didn't hang around with him and say, you know, okay, you're going to be one of my disciples. Good boy, you could really be a... Hey, look at... Somebody carry the disciples around and say, interesting that all his disciples were just normal men who did normal things. Were not these men that had been changed physically or anything. You'd think maybe he'd have them... Maybe kind of a parade of guys like that just to prove who he was. But anyway, so... They brought him to the Pharisees, the man who had formerly been blind. And now it was the Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud. So, Pharisees, this is verse 15. Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. He said to them, he put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. So the story's consistent, right? This is what happened. Allison?
I was thinking he's a very good communicator. If it wouldn't be controversial, I would want to use this like in my writing class. Like, see how much you can say in so few words? Yes. And then he makes it even shorter. He put mud on my eyes and I washed and I see. Yeah. End of story. I mean, like, it's like, he's preparing it in. So concise.
Yeah.
How nice.
I on the sermon I did some time ago after the it was a Sunday that my power had gone out on Friday, and I said, if the power had gone out, my sermon would have been shorter. Because that would have taken time. I didn't have the time to pare it down like I wanted to. But, so he's just cutting to the chase here, right? Hey, I was blind, and now I see. And he's not, this is interesting, because he's very cool, calm, and collected. He's not like jumping around everywhere. And just, you know, you don't get this picture, just like, you know, he's all, as you might expect, but he's not. Nolan?
I was just rereading the passage before he goes and washes, the part where the disciples are asking him about this man. It's not clear to me that he would have ever, I mean, besides what John maybe didn't record, but what's recorded is they're having this conversation, and then he just goes up to him and starts putting mud on this guy's face.
Yeah.
And I don't see any point where he's like, hi, I'm Jesus. I'm going to put mud on your face. Then you're going to do something and get your sight. It's kind of like he has this profound statement, I'm the light of the world, and then boom.
Yeah.
Right there, putting mud on his eyes. And this guy doesn't ask a single question. This goes and does it. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Like, regardless of what he understood before that happened, it's still a pretty big act of faith that, okay, this man just put mud on my face. I really hope he's Jesus, or else I'm going to be wasting time. And maybe the miracle, you know, started, like Brady was talking about, maybe the miracle immediately took effect so that he could get up and orient himself towards that pool.
That's a really good point. And it makes me think of, in contrast, with Naaman. Remember King Naaman, who was told to go, he had leprosy. You know, he told to go dip in the river seven times, and I thought you'd just say, you know, this and that, but this guy, he's very obedient. I never thought of that before. And this, I mean, he's very obedient to this, and he just does what he's told, and really without any, as far as we know, like you said, without any further information. That is pretty, always learn more. Terry.
I think what further corroborates that in verse 36 afterwards, The man asked, or when Jesus asked him, and in verse 36 he answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Mm-hmm. And then Jesus says, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. Mm-hmm. So, of course, this is the first time that He sees Jesus.
Yeah, yeah.
But he didn't recognize his voice. At least that's what I would infer from
that.
Otherwise, if someone healed you and spoke to you, I would remember that voice.
Mm-hmm.
Especially from what I do understand, those that have lost certain senses, the other senses become even more acute.
Yeah.
So it's hearing.
True.
Yeah. Unless it was damaged, would be very good.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, that's right. He did say, go to the Siloam and wash. So he went and washed. So he did hear that, but he didn't. Ed?
I know all the details aren't given to us in the Bible here.
Mm-hmm.
But in verse 7, John says, he went. He wasn't led or taken. How did he know where the pool was? In verse 11, he says, I went. Again, to me, this indicates he went by himself. Without any help. And how did he know who Jesus was? And again, we're not given all the details. It doesn't say that Jesus identified himself to
him. Those are good questions. I wonder, Brady mentioned in the other case, there was some sight, and maybe this was similar, that he could see enough to get somewhere. Or we don't know if he asked or, you know, if somebody led him, if it's just not recorded.
Mm-hmm.
But those are good questions of the text. I don't know the answer to those, but it is interesting. Kind of makes you think about several things about how we got there. Maybe you wanted to keep it shorter. I don't know. Interesting. But he knew all these things about the light of the world would certainly mean a lot to him then. What's also frustrating, I say frustrating in the sense that we don't know what happens after this. I would really like to know. This, he had to be quite a herald for the gospel, right? I mean, you can just imagine, because he's so bold to start with, and he's somewhat outspoken, considering the questions he's getting and the people who are asking him. They're like the police forces, you know, of Jerusalem. And he just as bold as he can be. So he must have done something after this that was good. These are just one of those cases where these things are left to your imagination in terms of what he might have done afterwards. But there are a lot of questions. It's one of those things that you want to know more about. Okay, we've got we probably don't have much time. But we do want to get to this. We get just quickly. They brought him to the Pharisees, the man who'd formerly been bright. Now it was a Sabbath day. He asked how he'd received his sight. He cuts it back down, as Elsa said. Some of the Pharisees said, so verse 16, some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. Can you believe that? I mean, this is just, he's healed man.
I say it's interesting. My Bible has a note that just says kneading, which could be dough or clay or anything like that, was one of the 39 classes of work that was forbidden on the Sabbath. So that's how deep into the weeds they were about this concept of not working. Kneading.
Kneading the mud.
39 classes.
Yeah.
And there's,
that's right. I mean, I don't know if you guys seen that list. You can Google it. You can Google everything these days. But the 39... of the classes of work on the Sabbath that you're not permitted to do. And it got expanded then, and then also the Jews found their ways around those things. So you could go three-fifths of a mile or something like that. You could do that on the Sabbath. So what they do is they put a lunch three-fifths of the mile out, eat the lunch and consider that a new start, and then they could go another three-fifths of a mile, that kind of stuff. Yeah, but so many tacks, I forget how many tacks you get, 39 tacks or something. 39 was a big number with him. 39 tacks in your sandals. You have 40, it's a burden. Stuff like that. I like the blind and bruised Pharisee. That's the ones that would not look at women, so they kept running into stuff. Because of bruised and blind Pharisees. Anyway, Richard is at the door. That must mean something. So we'll pick up from there. With the Pharisees and the parents and all that on Sunday.